And again, good morning. It's 9 o'clock and your dial is set at 94.3 FM. We are WOWD LP Tacoma Park. Standing in the shadows of love, I'm getting ready for the heartaches to come. Can't you see me standing in the shadows of love? I'm getting ready for the heartaches to come. I wanna run, but there's nowhere to go, 'cause heartaches will follow me, I know. Without your love, the love I need, it's the beginning of the end for me. 'Cause you're taking away all my reasons for living when you pushed aside all the love I've been giving. Now wait a minute, didn't I treat you right now, baby? Didn't I do the best I could? Now didn't I? So don't you leave me standing in the shadow.
Good morning, everyone. It's cold here in the metro area, but we have a hot show for you today. Hope you're having a great start to your day. We hope you can join you with your, you can join us with your morning J.O., your O.J., and your breakfast tea, or even your smoothie. We want to be the cream cheese schmear on your bagel this morning, and the jelly on your English muffin, maybe the butter on your toast, or the blueberries in your scone. And lastly, the chocolate on your croissant. And we want to get you juiced to be talking about art. You're tuned to WOWD-LP Tacoma Park. It is 94.3 on your FM station. This is your community radio station, and we hope you're enjoying us on the airways. We hope you've enjoyed Meg and her eclectic mix of tunes to start your morning. This is Tom Xenakis, and I'm with Sheila Blake, and we are the hosts of the Artist Experience radio show. We hope you enjoyed our previous programming.
Hi, the Artist Experience is an hour radio show dedicated to looking at art. We feel that people really want a way to think about art and look at it. And so that's the point of our show, really, to give you a little entree. And hopefully when you visit the exhibit, you can create in your own experience your own work of art. We have an Artist Experience page on Facebook where we put images of the things we're talking about. It's also cool. And it's a place we'd love our listeners to give us ideas and feedback. And also, we have a new web page. It's www.artistexperience. And if you look at that, you can get all of our podcasts. So we hope you will. You can go back, and if there's anything you want to hear again or haven't heard, go into that. So we're at WOWDLP Tacoma Park, and we're always looking to improve our community radio station.
Well, here at Artist Experience Radio Program, we like to stay current. We present art exhibitions at art venues that are important, and we love to share this with you. Also, we like to see what's trending in our society, the current events that shape art, our community, and our nation, and our world. We had and will have a program on politics and art because Washington, D.C. is the place that's constantly buzzing about politics, and artists like to respond to that, especially visually. The current events in the last year has been, you know, looking at topics that revolve around the sexes. Topics like entertaining the idea of a woman for president was a recent current event, and issues of gender equality in the workplace. There's lots to talk about in the U.S. and all over the globe about this. Very current and very important issues of sexual harassment in the workplace and in the political arena and in Hollywood. They're just popping up everywhere, like now. Of course, sexual harassment in the workplace can occur with both sexes as being victims. But in the media, right, this very second, there are prominent Americans, and I mean prominent, that have been accused of sexual harassment in the workplace then and now. So Sheila and I decided to tackle the subject relating to gender equality. But we want to talk about this in the art world, where both men and women are partnered as visual artists, artists in a marriage, possibly a partnership, or just a relationship between an accomplished female artist and her husband's spouse or significant other or mate. Our opening number, Standing in the Shadows of Love, was from around 1967 by the Four Tops, and it kind of is our intro to the show. Sheila, am I opening Pandora's box here? Weren't you married to an artist once? Weren't you a two-artist family? Were you not?
We were. But I'm going to start a little back when I was 18 years old, and I'm going to lead you into my life, and I hope I'm not getting too personal here.
Okay.
So art school saved me. When I went to art school, it was extremely demanding, and they let you know right away, right from the start, that this was a privilege, and they could take it away in a heartbeat. The students were all on scholarship, and some of the guys drove cabs at night, and the girls all lived at home, and I did too, till I couldn't stand it anymore. But art was the most serious thing anyone could attempt to do, and there was so much rigorous learning. Our teachers were all men, but we didn't question that. They were all artists, and it was only later that I found out that it was a kind of an old boys' network. And so for the boys, it was an entree into the art world. Some of our classmates became famous, but we wouldn't have ever thought about having a beer with our teachers after class. For the girls, there was no time or thought about networking or internships or whatever it is people do now. We were just becoming artists. And I remember carrying my big paintings back to my apartment. They were like sails, and the wind would try to like fly me away in the streets of New York.
I can relate to that too.
Oh boy. So we were really immersed in this life. And my friends graduated and taught college, and me too, in a more circuitous route. But once I wasn't in school, I had to define myself. Women as students were equal. I never had the feeling that that there was a guy who was getting more attention. I felt that we were taken very seriously. But after school, the women I knew, they wouldn't even show each other their work. They were just so, somehow there was an intimidation. So I've been married three times. The first time was to a great-looking kid who was a craftsman. And we had a leather shop in the village, and he was always entertaining the customers. Most of them were young girls from the High School of Music and Art who were coming down to the village to get their sandals and leather bags. And the guys, too. And I was sitting behind the sewing machine with my baby in a box beside me. And every time I'd make a little mistake and make a hole out of place in the leather bag, he would say, "Sheila, baby."
Oh, good.
So there was a time when I had this thought. It just came to me. I thought, it isn't right for two people to live one life, his life. And I knew that it was the way I was going to have to be, but I didn't know how I was going to be able to do that.
Wow.
So my second husband was an artist, a real artist, a really good student. And he was completely dedicated, and he was also gifted. But the deal was the same, that I would do everything I could to make sure he had every chance to paint. I was also a painter, and I did paint and change diapers, cook, clean, carpool, teach, and model. But I never stopped painting. For 15 years, I did that. I was really dependent on his critiques. And he was good. So once I knew I had to get a divorce, I had to wean myself away from that dependency. I told him that he couldn't come to my studio, which was my garage. And that was a major step. My ex-husband never did make it to the big leagues in art, something he resented and felt he deserved. And he resented me and the kids from keeping him from living in New York. I actually now think he could have made it as a really big-time artist. It's just luck. Because his work really was terrific, and he felt himself to be great.
Well, thanks for sharing that, Sheila.
Yeah, so now my husband, Peter, he became an engineer, partly for himself and partly so he could support me while I painted. That's the deal. So here I am still painting, still battling and believing in my art. In the 80s, women began to claim their place as important artists. Some did, but it's like trying to lift a great stone over your head. Here's a conversation I have at every party I go to. And what do you do? I'm a painter, an artist. Oh, my mom paints. She's taken classes, and she did some collage and some encaustic. I'm not disparaging them, but how do you say it's my life's work? Women artists have a different way of looking at it.
Well, today we want to explore other couples besides Sheila and her ex-husband in the history of art that were prominent in the art world and both accomplished artists like Sheila and her husband. We have time for only four couples, unfortunately, but there are about 12 couples out there of significance that were married and partnered. We have Man Ray, the famous photographer and multimedia artist, and his wife Lee Miller. We have Ben Nicholson, the painter, and Barbara Hepworth, the sculptor, and they were both British and both accomplished. Charles Ames and Ray Ames were both sculptors, designers, and architects. Max Ernst and Dorothea Tanning, both accomplished painters, and we have Pablo Picasso and Françoise Guillet, both painters, and she was his model, and Robert and Sonia Stern de Launay, both painters, and Jasper Johns and Robert Rauschenberg, a gay couple that were partners for 6 years in the pop art era. But there's some others that we want to talk about today that most of you will know their names. So Sheila, take it away. Who are we going to talk about today?
Well, we're going to talk about some really famous artists that were couples. And, excuse me, there's a lot of juicy stuff and a lot of beautiful art. But remember, the female artists of these couples really had to work hard in the shadows of their more famous male partners. The gender equality question was a big deal then, and it's still a big deal. All you have to do is listen to the news.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
We're going to talk about Alfred Stieglitz and Georgia O'Keeffe, Diego Rivera and Frida Kahlo, Jackson Pollock and Lee Krasner, and Willem de Kooning and Elaine de Kooning.
Well, I think it's really important to put this issue of gender equality in an historical and cultural perspective. We touched upon this in an early show about criticism and women sharing their views on art. What were the powers that be thinking about women artists? Never mind those partnered to a famous male artist like the ones we're going to talk about today. Historically, it was about opportunity. Were women granted opportunity in education, art education, and tutelage to study under some master if they showed aptitude or talent? In centuries past, women might have an opportunity if their father or grandfather was an accomplished painter and they were connected in the academies of art. Of course, wealthy women that were connected to wealthy men in lineage, royalty, and marriage were granted some opportunities. These are instances that a family's wealth helped their female child to pursue art as a hobby or recreation. I think it's safe to say that the women's place was definitely not in the art studio of the centuries past. There are famous female examples like Artemisia Gentileschi, Cecilia Beaux, Mary Cassatt, Berthe Morisot, and a few prominent French female artists of the 17th and 18th century. These artists were not in the shadows of famous artist husbands, and they were a fiery brand of talent, fortitude, and vision. Their work and their lives are very much trailblazing in their day and when they worked. Sheila, what about these artists that we're going to be talking about today and their relationship to the art world and then the shadows of their more famous husbands? I would like a female perspective on this.
Oh, boy, you'll get one.
Okay. Oh, I knew I would.
So by the end of the 19th century, there were a few women artists, a few whose names you probably recognize. But this is true. 3 to 5% of artworks on major museum walls are by women artists. And that's now. So you might recognize Berthe Morisot and Mary Cassatt, maybe Camille Claudel because she was the partner of Rodin, Cecilia Beaux, and Suzanne Valadon, who was Maurice Utrillo's mother. And she was a great exception. She was well known during her lifetime. But she was mostly known for her bohemian lower class lifestyle. She worked as a model, and she was also a model for Renoir. Oftentimes the paintings that you see of Renoir's were Suzanne Valadon. And her class allowed her to enter the male public domain of art through modeling and then emerge as an artist within her circle of prominent male artists. So for a long time, art was housed in private collections, and then those collections were opened to the public, and that's how museums got started. Commercial art galleries came about in the middle of the 19th century. Of course, in Europe, there were salons and dealers, and dealers in prints and paintings, and then the Steins, Gertrude and Leo, who bought their first painting of Cézanne in 1878. These new experimental artists were happy to sell paintings, and having a gallery wasn't the measure of success that it's somehow considered now. And I know from becoming an artist in the 1950s and 60s that it was a man's profession. There was something considered in the genetic makeup that a woman just didn't have. The abstract expressionist was religion, and the artist as a prophet had to be a man. This changed somewhat with the women's movement, but part of it was practical. Being an artist was incompatible with having a family, and men expected to be first and have their needs met by women. Women could, even in the older times, they could be decorators, they could be painters of china, watercolorists, which was clean and portable. And there were women portrait painters like Sandy Caldy's mother. But even drawing the nude figure at art school, holy cow. And if a woman was really talented and worked hard, what man would benefit from taking her seriously?
Wow, that's heavy stuff, actually.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I could cry. So until the women's movement, the Guerrilla Girls and the new feminist art critics like Linda Nochlin, that began to challenge the myth of the great artist as genius. Genius is thought of a mysterious power that's somehow embedded in the person of the great artist. This is a godlike conception of the artist's role. And it's due to the entire romantic, elitist, individual glorifying and monograph producing subculture upon which the profession of art history is based. Nochlin develops this farther by arguing that if a woman had the golden nugget of artistic genius, it would reveal itself, but it had never revealed itself because they didn't have the chance. QED, women's do not have the golden nugget of artistic genius. So Nochlin deconstructs the myth of the genius by highlighting the unjustness in which the Western art world inherently privileges certain predominantly white male artists. In Western art, genius is a title that is generally reserved for artists such as Van Gogh, Picasso, Raphael, and Pollock, all white men. At this point, artistic genius started collapsing, and women and marginal groups emerged at the forefront of artistic creation.
So, you know, I remember talking with the late abstract expressionist Grace Hartigan about this topic of women artists in the 1940s and the 1950s. She was brutally candid about this. The first generation of abstract expressionists in New York City were predominantly men, except for Hedda Stern, who was a kind of a critic and sometimes painter. She was the only woman. This group of men were candidly photographed for Life magazine at the genesis of the explosion of abstract expressionism that stole the center of the art world and brought it to America in New York City, and they were known as the Irascibles. Well, breaking through the barriers was tough, but the female artists of the second generation, like Joan Mitchell, Helen Frankenthaler, and Grace Hartigan, were smart, resourceful, and some tough women. They had the talent, and they earned some respect, but it never came easy. They had very supportive husbands, and there were somewhat comfortable households, and the husbands were not artists, and it gave them the freedom to paint, but this still was never an easy road for them. So let's start out with our first couple, and we're going to explore the relationship between Alfred Stieglitz and Georgia O'Keeffe. We will introduce every one of our artist couples with a song. So let's start this with this duo with Aretha Franklin's Respect from 1967.
Oh,
So, hi. So, I'm going to talk about Alfred Stieglitz and Georgia O'Keeffe. Alfred Stieglitz was a photographer. He was a really fabulous photographer. And he was the first person to introduce photography as an art form, which was not about copying painting, but it was as being equal to it. He had an art gallery and with some experimental artists like John Marin, Arthur Dove, Marston Hartley. And he was married and he had a daughter when he met Georgia O'Keeffe. She had sent him some of her drawings. She was teaching in Texas and she asked him not to show them, which is a little coy, but he did show them immediately. And when they met, she was 28 and he was 52. They had a passionate relationship from the start and they were married in 1924. He'd been looking for his identical twin and Georgia O'Keeffe became one for a while. And even though he took her art very seriously, he was driven to expound his theories of modern art and keep his gallery going, as well as working on his own photographs. And he was a demanding, spoiled man. And who would take care of his petty needs and model endlessly for those fabulous photographs we all know? Still, it was Georgia, and she had equal entry into the art world. But she was also driven and demanding. And so in 1929, she began her fabulous paintings in New Mexico and began to spend a part of every year there. Stieglitz found another woman to love, but he continued to love her also and show her work. My favorite accounts about Georgia O'Keeffe in New Mexico that I always remember were that she had a woman companion servant who would go into the desert with her and light a fire to warm the ground so that she could paint. And another observation came from Elliot Porter, who said, if Georgia wanted something you had, she would ask you for it, and if you wouldn't give it to her, she'd take it.
Oh, wow, Sheila. I don't know about that relationship, reading about Stieglitz and O'Keeffe. It was exotic, it was erotic, economic, entrepreneurial, and endearing. To me, it broke the love meter. I mean, I have to say, these two are a bit over the top. You know, I think I'm just hanging around the right lovey-dovey odd crowd. I don't know, I'm missing something. Just the research made my blood pressure rise. And goodness gracious, those two were that much in love. Stieglitz had his hands in everything, making photography, new and innovative photography techniques, establishing professional photography clubs, institutions, finding galleries to support photography as a fine art medium. And he was the art dealer himself, as you say. That is like three people combined into one. The truth is, he was a great innovative photographer. I don't know how he did it all. And then when they met, he was 52 and very famous and established. She was 28, kind of really unknown. There are tomes of research about their relationship, 700 pages of correspondence, gulp. Did they have time to make art, photography, and paint? I have to say, this was a real eye-opener. He had come from a long-established unhappy marriage, and he had an ego that was like wider than the Grand Canyon. I mean, he was established that he enjoyed the women as part of his life, and he enjoyed her artistic side in Georgia O'Keeffe, and he enjoyed her art. O'Keeffe was described herself as being seen as a kind of heat. That's how he saw her, as a kind of heat. I mean, that's another gulp. No wonder that he had so many heart problems. I hope he had a good cardiologist, because man, he never slowed down. And you know, we have to get back to Georgia O'Keeffe, because she really was an amazing artist.
Well, Georgia O'Keeffe is our symbol, a great woman artist, and she is. And even when I get so tired of all those posters of skulls and flowers, and still, I'm always amazed when I see her paintings at her clarity, the beautiful edges, her fine abstract compositions, and her story. I mean, forget about her selfishness. She did it. And she never stopped. And even when she was old, and she lived till she was 99 and she was blind, she began to make ceramic sculptures. She had a young man. Maybe he was self-serving. Maybe he loved her. He was devoted to her. And maybe they were alike. When she died, there was a big lawsuit about her value in her work.
Huh, I didn't know that.
Yes.
Well, you know, by 1929, they had a 13-year relationship, and she started venturing out of his influence and with those trips to the Southwest. And I think the thing about O'Keeffe represents independence of a female artistic vision and subject. And by 65, Stieglitz knew he had lost her, and he became bitter, even though he still promoted her for years. The legacy of O'Keeffe is that she represents a modern woman willing to balance her artistic sensibilities, her career, her marriage, and her independence. This is very important for a creative person. Her artistic vision also ventures into unknown territory for a woman artist at the time, because she kind of speaks of a peaceable kingdom outside of the urban art world, and she finds inspiration in feminism, her femaleness, and the nature and spirit of what an independent woman is, and her beautiful paintings. So let's start our next couple with another song. Well, the relationship of Diego Rivera and Frida Kahlo could really be a topic for an entire show, and this is the couple we're going to talk about next. We talked a little about their relationship in our radio program on the visual arts and cinema. Frida, the movie from 2002, was a really good one, and much of the movie highlighted the tumultuous relationship of Diego Rivera and Frida Kahlo. The movie was well done, and we recommended it then, and we recommend it now. When I think of this relationship, I think of the color red, red hot. I mean, two very passionate Latin lovers aspiring to great artistic heights on their own levels. They were entirely different entities, yet Diego always overshadowed Frida Kahlo. To me, this is a no-brainer, a Mexican male and a Mexican female in a Mexican society at the time in the late 1920s. The macho act was alive and well in Mexico, and Diego was a really macho man, and he had an incredible ego. He was a braggart, he was a womanizer, and he had a really big art following. Diego was already known was and he went as inspiration to Europe when he was 21 years old, and he was kind of a prodigy. I think, you know, Diego was definitely a prodigy. And he was well known for his powerful paintings and murals, and he was an advocate of Marxism and political change in Mexico.
So Frida had a German father and a Mexican mother, and she began having a lovely childhood. She was there's a lot of intellectual talk. There was she had a lot of freedom. She was a very lovely and living girl, and she had polio in her childhood, and it left her with physical problems. And then when she was 18, she was in a terrible bus accident where she was impaled by a post that left her in pain for the rest of her life. She had been going to be a medical student, but she'd liked art as a child. And so in the aftermath of her accident, she began painting while she was still in bed. And then she sought out Diego Rivera. And he saw her greatness. Actually, he saw her as maybe greater than him.
Yes, it's true.
Yeah, and somewhat as Georgia O'Keeffe did with Stieglitz, she sought him out so she could get into the serious art world. And that relationship gave her entrance. She was always overshadowed by Rivera, but she was able to have her work shown and collected, and now Frida Kahlo is our symbol of a woman artist who overcame terrible hardship and gave us her gifts as her art and as an icon.
Yeah, that interesting relationship was secured by many kind of things that they both enjoyed, like Marxism and the concept of a freer post-colonial Mexico. But Frida took it to the core. Diego often expressed that Frida was actually a better artist and more true to her art than he was. She dressed in native, indigenous, and peasant clothing of a Mexican woman. She was uniquely beautiful. Her parents called her relationship with Diego and her daughter Frida the relationship between an elephant and a dove. Kahlo was exposed to the art of collections in the U.S. because she traveled with Diego often to the U.S. Her style can be described as surreal and very autobiographical. This is where she shines as an artist. This unique communication of subject was radical in Mexico for a Latina woman. She was unafraid of exposing her magical reality and the personal pains and struggles she was communicating in her relationship to gender, social class, political views, and again, post-colonial Mexico. Her work incorporated a naive, folk, primitive style that was very visually honest, but retrogressive at the time. Her subject was not her subway was very progressive, but her style was actually retrogressive, very similar to Mexican styles before that. She got her big break when her work was seen by André Breton, the true founder of Surrealism. Connection to the Julian Levy Gallery in 1930 was a big thing, and she had a show with a smashing success in 1939. And then the Louvre bought one of her paintings, the first Mexican painting bought by
really?
The Louvre. Yeah, I was
wow.
very impressed by that.
Yeah, me too. Well, her legacy in feminism and art was real, but I think her great legacy was that her art was so personal. Even she employed folk art and symbolism and a kind of surrealism, but to tell her story. And there was another artist, Leonora Carrington, who had a relationship with Max Ernst, who lived a lot longer. And there is a big similarity between those women artists. But if you think about it, Frida Kahlo, she is much more famous. And all these women seem to need a man to gain acceptance. How else to get into it and have their art collected and preserved, which is a big thing, because in order to have value in your art so it doesn't get thrown in the trash, you need to have a certain kind of value placed on your art.
Interesting, yes, that you bring that up.
Yeah.
Thank you, yeah.
So women are looking for symbols. And among artists, there are a few, and Kahlo's story of survival is the thing we can grab onto. She's never been my favorite artist, But I need to say also that Salma Hayek, who played Frida Kahlo in the movie, and in my mind is inseparable from okay. her, has detailed her horrible, humiliating treatment by Harvey Weinstein while she made that movie. So history repeats itself.
Oh, wow. Yeah, absolutely.
It's true.
Well, time has really helped Frida Kahlo in the generations of feminism that fueled her renaissance and reviews. Frida Kahlo's work stands apart in her uniquely feminine style and way, and she has a power and bravado and sheer guts. We have to take a station break now, so we'll come back and we'll also have a tune for us.
WOWDLP Tacoma Park is giving so much with our diverse radio programming. The incredible music variety, information about topics that are important to our community, and you are an important part of that. We invite you to give as well by supporting our radio station with contributions to help us expand and grow. So go online at tacomaradio.org and see ways that you can help us support the music programming, the dialogue, and the information of community events and the actions of community radio. Your sponsorship and financial contributions are greatly appreciated.
This is dedicated to the one I
going to introduce Jackson Pollock and Lee Krasner. They were another artist dynamic duo, and I'm telling you.
They were.
So Lee Krasner was the sixth of seven children born to Russian Jewish immigrants. She was born in 1908, and they immigrated here from Bessarabia. So she grew up in immigrant Jewish neighborhoods in Brooklyn, and Krasner was born Lena Krasner, but she changed her name several times in the early portion of her life, eventually settling on Lee Krasner by the late 1940s. And art historians have wondered if she abbreviated the Lee as an attempt to disguise her gender.
Ah, very interesting.
It is interesting.
Well, I didn't know
yeah.
that.
Yeah. But by the time she was 13, Krasner had already decided she was going to become a professional artist. And it was an unusual career choice for an immigrant and a woman. And she applied to, and she was very happy to be accepted by Washington Irving High School in New York City, which was the only public high school at the time that allowed women to study art. She was really gutsy. She went to Cooper Union and the Art Students League, so she got a solid art education that served her well.
Well, she was a terrific artist. She was smart and savvy, and her educational background and her vision as an artist were really sound. She studied with the best of them, George Bridgman and Hans Hoffman. She was well-versed in in art history and well-spoken, and she was aware of the New York City art scene. Like many of the artists at the time of the Great Depression, she took advantage of opportunities in the works of the WPA, also known as the Works Progress Administration. These were really difficult times, and Lee Krasner was a go-getter, and I mean this in a good way. She knew what to do to create art, and in the most difficult of times. She was connected to the New York scene, and when Jackson Pollock showed up, she was willing to help, and he was an outsider. She knew the critics, she knew the gallery owners and other artists in the abstract expressionist movement in New York City. And she knew where to hang out, at, like the Cedar Bar, and she knew how to make connections. She introduced Jackson Pollock to Wilhelm de Kooning and Peggy Guggenheim and so many others. In this sense, I think Lee was enthusiastic, giving, and faithful. I mean faithful because she really did believe in Jackson Pollock. She saw the genius in Pollock. She also saw his pain. In the movie Pollock from 2002, which is another movie we talked about in a previous programming, this really goes into their relationship. This was not an easy relationship, as Jackson Pollock had a lot of emotional issues, anxieties, addictions, and afflictions.
And during the Depression, many artists were kept financially afloat thanks to Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal programs, which also offered them camaraderie. The WPA, the New Deal Project, provided essential financial support to women artists, many of whom were provided their first professional opportunities. And Krasner got into a supervisory position, and she also worked as an assistant on large-scale public murals. In turn, Pollock served as her assistant on WPA murals. Throughout her career, she directly confronted the dominant stereotype that women can't paint and struggled within the abstract expressionist movement, which prized masculinity and heroic figures such as Pollock.
Well, Lee Krasner was always making art, even during the relationship with Jackson Pollock, but she received no recognition at that time because Pollock took center stage in a huge way. In some ways, their work fed off each other in a positive way. I would say their artistic relationship was so symbiotic in the sense that they grew from each other and together, and their work entwined in many ways. In 1949, both Pollock and Krasner exhibited in an exhibition titled Artist, Man and Wife. Although both their works were well received, Krasner was always compared to Pollock, and it was clear that the male-dominated art world would always not give her due, and her association with Pollock was what cemented her life with the critics. And at that time, she actually signed her work LK, and I think that's very telling as well. She just had initials. While Pollock was alive, and after 1956, Lee Krasner began to show her work, and the death and the media attention kind of gave her a little more attention in her own life, and her own work began to blossom. She continued to work at the Springs, their Long Island studio, and she continued to go to make art, and I think that was a great thing about her.
Well, Krasner's legacy was really that despite her absolutely impossible commitment to keep Pollock sober and working and connected, she was also a wonderful painter. Her ideas were based on her interpretations of Mondrian and Matisse, and they were tough and they were lyrical, and they broke through the figure ground in a way that was different from de Kooning and Pollock. After Krasner's death when she was 75, thanks to her generosity, the Pollock Krasner Foundation was established with the goal of assisting the development of fine artists. The artists have to demonstrate need and a long-time commitment. Since its creation in 1985, the foundation has awarded over $46 million in grants to working artists around the world. She also left a $50,000 award for an individual artist each year. And when an artist manages to break through the men's world to become great, it takes everything. That's her real legacy, that she did that.
Yeah, she absolutely did. Well, you know, WOWDLP Tacoma Park is 17 or so months old, and the Artist Experience Radio program has been here since the beginning. We're having incredible fun, aren't we?
We are. We definitely
And we are committed to taking you to great local art venues to experience art and to see art on the journey with us. You're an important part of this program and our growth. As we have grown to enjoy our diverse program as a local community radio station, we now ask you to help us out with a financial contribution and support our unique and invented programming at WOWDLP Tacoma Park. There's no other program like Artist Experience in the entire cosmos. So take take a moment between your sips of coffee and your nibbles on your scone and go on to our website at www.tacomaradio.org and press the donate button. And your support will help us with your listening pleasure, and you deserve us 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We thank you, and we invite you to tell your friends how good it feels to listen to WWDLP and be an important supporter of our local radio station. Well, admittedly, the last couple we're going to talk about today is one that I knew little about. I read the book on Wilhelm de Kooning, written by Anna Lynn Swan and Mark Stevens from 2004, and I was kind of semi-interested in Wilhelm de Kooning's art and knew very little about his partner, Lane de Kooning. His personality had been revealed in a host of movies, and his essence is kind of tattooed, and after reading the book and seeing his movies about him, I kind of was turned off. And the rules of their relationship were very wide open, and it was also a sign of the times. There was alcoholism and infidelities, separations and reunions, and there was a lot of mix in these two talented artists. But Sheila, I really enjoy the work of Elaine de Kooning much more. She was another Brooklyn gal, and she was kind of impressive in her knowledge and social skills. She was a writer, a critic, and a teacher, and a champion of feminism. She was sociable and well-adjusted and effervescent. She knew the New York City art scene. Of course, he was an immigrant coming from Holland. She was a magnet of discussion and fun, as her husband was much more solitary and evasive. Elaine was unafraid of the male-dominated pool of hard-hitting abstract artists of the day in New York City. I think it's true that she was a really good draftsperson. She could draw, and she enjoyed it. Many works exist from life, drawings of de Kooning and all the people in her spheres. But she gave up a lot for the abuses of de Kooning with his binges and extramarital affairs, where their relationship dissolved in 1957. Her separation found that she had to really work hard, and she was really good at working hard.
So here's where we don't agree.
I know, and it's about time.
Yeah, well, I want to say that Elaine was a partier. She was incredibly social. She was incredibly pretty. And Wilhelm de Kooning, he was not a partier. He sort of became an alcoholic, not because of partying, but because a friend of his, when he first came to this country and he was having to get up really early and go to work, and he had a hard time waking up, and his friend said, why don't you just take a drink when you get up in the morning? It'll help you wake up. And that was the beginning of his alcoholism, which really became terrible. Mm. But and there's a painting by Elaine de Kooning of Jack Kennedy that I was just happened to be looking at the other day in the portrait gallery in the American Museum. And I don't think it's wonderful. It's of its time. It's an effort to combine abstract expressionism and the figure. And there's also a drawing that she did, a study for the painting. And she got the eyes and the mouth great. She really did. But she blew off that nose. And and it certainly is a completely much more interesting a painting than those deadly portraits of the presidents that are in the portrait gallery, and those children have to come and sit in front of them and learn about George Washington. But I want to say that they were both really important artists, and they were artists for their whole lives. So that I'll give them.
Okay, well, there's something about her work in portraiture that I found engaging. She's painting the portrait in the day of Alice Neal, Alex Katz, Philip Perlstein, Will Barnett, and Leonard Anderson. There was a very, remember the figurative days of the 1970s?
Right.
And a lot of the artists kind of look similar. Mm-hmm. But she had a little more energy like de Kooning's work and somewhat like Giacometti. And the others were much more subdued. So I think she stood apart than the others. And I have to say she was very, very comfortable in the figurative work. And I think that, you know, things have gotten better for her. Well, how about those critics that she was really, really big on? Like Jill Johnson and Lucy.
Oh, yeah. Jill Johnson actually was a critic for the Village Voice, and she was a lesbian and a feminist. And Lucy Lepard, Linda Nochlin, who I talked about before, they were great. They really championed women artists, and not as lesser, but as more. And women they started their own art galleries. They made their own way without the men. And the list of artists who are well known, not just for who their husbands were, has really expanded. When I was preparing for this show, I was looking at the statistics for women artists, and it really made me want to cry. It's terrible. Museum shows, gallery salaries. But I think there's a general acceptance that women can be important artists and that they've lived past their own generations. Photographers like Bernice Abbott, Margaret Bourke-White, Eva Hesse, Judy Chicago, Agnes Martin, Louise Bourgeois, Louise Nevelson, and now there are current artists, Jenny Seville, Cara Walker, she's fabulous, Lee Bonacieux. So we'll have to see, but they have really arisen as great artists.
Absolutely, now. Agree yeah. with that, yeah. Well, you know, the artists we talked about today were influential in their own right as couples, and the partnerships of years ago, the female artists were really never as prominent as their male counterparts in the relationship. That's just a fact. These women artists were pioneering, brave, and they fought to have their art communicated to a wider audience in America. Truthfully, they were lucky that, in fact, they were in America, because women artists in many parts of the globe were just beginning to be recognized in their own societies. And that's changing fast with global technology, and that's all a good thing. Well, we hope you enjoyed the show. Sheila, tell our listeners just for a second about what's upcoming here.
Well, on Saturday, December 30th, we're going to have a rebroadcast of one of our great shows. So please listen in, because Tom and I will both be looking at art on the North Pole or wherever we are each going for our own holidays. But in the new year, Tom and I have been working on a busy schedule, and we have the calendar worked out with lots of visual variety. We'll venture into the world of Latin American art and what is here locally, which is really great.
A lot of stuff. in the new year. Well, stay tuned to our next exciting program here at WOWTLP Tacoma Park. We have Bobby Hill coming up. Don't change that dial. And he's going to have an incredible show. And his knowledge of musical depth is amazing. This music, which is coming up at 10 a.m. up till 1 p.m., we have avant-garde jazz right there, and please stay tuned. We also have Bobby on Wednesdays for Borderlines. No borders, no lines, just great musical variety. We'd like for you to listen in to our friend Gail Behrens on next Sunday from 8 to 10 p.m. with The Night Ride Home. Gail serves up an eclectic and selective mix of songs. Please see our website, TacomaRadio.org, and look at the program schedule. There's so much fantastic music, talk shows, interviews, and community news. And don't forget while you're there to press the donate button. Until next time, see art in everything you do, experience the visual. Have a great afternoon, and thanks for listening, and happy holidays.
And happy holidays.